Okay, it's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Governor Evers has declared today Indigenous Peoples Day across Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll get a Native American viewpoint on what the recognition means for the state's Indigenous people. First, communication skills in the workplace are important for everyone, but women can feel some extra pressure, especially when it comes to being nice. Be too nice and you risk not being taken seriously. Be too assertive, you could be seen as unpleasant or alienating. At least that's the conventional wisdom. Our next guest has spent decades working with women on how to advance in the workplace and has lots of suggestions on how to navigate around the nice. Lois Frankel is an author, consultant, and expert on leadership development for women. Her books include See Jane Lead and Nice Girls Still Don't Get the Corner Office. Lois, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Lois, I spelled it out a little there, but give us more detail on this double standard, this double bind of nice for women.
Yeah, you know, everyone has to be nice. Nice is necessary for success, but it's not sufficient. And if you think of it on a continuum from really nasty to overly nice, right? You know, at one end of the continuum, you have somebody like Sally Field. I mean, she's the quintessential nice girl, right? And then the other end of the continuum, you might have somebody like Leona Helmsley, who is the Queen of Mean. And so you can't be at either end of the continuum and really make your voice heard and your point known effectively. You've got to be able to incorporate little elements of both and find this place for yourself in the middle.
Do men face this at all or anywhere near as much as women do?
Nowhere near as much. For men, they could be as assertive as they like, and they're not going to get called out of bounds. For women, when they communicate in the exact same way that a man may communicate, exactly the same, she'll get called pushy or, you know, the dreaded B word or strident, and he'll get called assertive. And we see this happen over and over and over again in all industries across the board.
Yeah, talk about what happens for a woman in a workplace who just goes all in on just being nice. How do people see her?
As a doormat, as a pushover. If you're always nice, people won't take you seriously. Because if you're always nice, it means you're not making the tough calls when they need to be made as well. And you're not having the difficult conversations that have to be had, those kinds of things. And you let people walk all over you and you don't say anything. So, you know, if you're at the Sally Field end of the continuum, you know, when you get an award, you're saying things like, you like me, you really like me, which really detracts from your credibility.
Talking to Lois Frankel, author of books including Nice Girls, Still Don't Get the Corner Office, about the nice conundrum for women in the workplace. Well, Lois, let's talk about a situation. A woman wants to make the case for her, say, idea, her pitch in the workplace. How does she steer the shoals between nice and, you know, being called, as you said, the B word?
Yeah, what a woman needs to do, and, you know, I have a new book coming out on this, by the way, which is Nice Girls Don't Speak Up or Stand Out, because that's really what the issue is. And so in the book, I really talk to women about how you need to develop a skill set that allows you to tell people to go to hell so they look forward to the trip. Because really, that's the challenge that a woman has, is that she needs to say it in such a way that it's palatable. So there's a couple things she can do. First of all, you know, I always say relationships are the WD-40 of being able to communicate powerfully for women, that it greases the skids. And that it's if you have a relation built with someone, they are more likely to listen to what you say non-defensively. So that's number one. Number two is being able to communicate your message in non-emotional but factual terms, right? Rather than say, you know, I've worked really hard and I really deserve a raise. That's really not going to work for you. It needs to be factual. It needs to be something along the lines of, you know, I've been here now for a year, and when I started, I was told that if I met all my goals, I would get a raise within the year. And I'm wondering when this is going to happen. Okay, that's one thing you can do. Another thing for women who are a little bit more hesitant to want to do that, there's a technique that's called contrasting. And it's contrasting what you do want, you don't want. And again, guys don't have to do this, which is really, you know, it's not fair, but it is how it is. I always say to people, don't shoot the messenger. You know, I'm just kind of explaining the rules. I don't make them. But contrasting. And contrasting is when I say what I do want and I don't want. So it might be, you know, I don't want you to think I'm not grateful for everything that you've done for me, because I am. At the same time, when I started, I was told that I'd get a raise within a year, and we're at the year mark, and I'd like to talk about how to make that happen. So you can hear, I'm being direct and straightforward, but at the same time, I'm being nice.
Another piece of advice you've given is that women should not ask permission when they don't need to. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, women tend to ask permission far more than men. And what I mean is that it's better to ask forgiveness than to ask permission. If you have an idea, there's a couple things you could do, you know, or if there's something that you want to do, you can just go ahead and do it. And then if someone says, well, wait a minute, we didn't talk about this, you can kind of feign surprise, right? Like, oh, you know, this is consistent with our goals. I had no idea that it might ruffle some feathers. Sure, let's talk about it. That's without apologizing, if you notice. Or the other thing you can do is inform. And so rather than ask permission, say, you know, I would just like to tell you that I plan to do XYZ. And if there's any problems with that, you can let me know. And move forward.
You just mentioned apologizing, and I assume this is something you may have talked about. This gets talked about a lot, whether women are too quick to apologize, even when there's not really a subject of the apology.
Oh, yes, we apologize for everything, don't we? It's like we over-apologize. And again, what I talk about is the fact that women need to understand that we expect children in our society to apologize. Now, if you do something egregiously wrong, of course I would expect you to apologize. If you're a consultant and you did something with a client that was really uncalled for or unnecessary, of course you'd apologize. But most situations, it's enough to be able to say, oh, I had no idea that this wasn't how you wanted it, or, oh, look at this, didn't quite come out the way I wanted. Let me think about how I can redo this. So it's more about reframing it than about apologizing for it. If it's a little bit bigger mistake, what people really want to know is that you learned from it. And so being able to say, boy, did I learn a lesson from this. Here's what I won't do again next time. But again, not apologizing.
You've been working on these issues for a while now, Lois. Have you seen any change in workplace culture? Are things getting a little more even for women on these expectations?
You know, I think things are moving at glacial speed. Because, yes, I've been working in this arena for quite a few years, probably close to 40 years. And some of the things we talked about 40 years ago, I am still talking about. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is I see a younger generation of women who have higher expectations for the workforce, who come into the workforce expecting that there's going to be more equality, that the playing field is going to be even, that they're going to be able to say the same things as men and not get called names. So they're coming in with that expectation, which people my generation and even the generation after didn't come in with. So we are seeing that change, and then that's forcing some change. But it's still not happening very quickly, because young women in their 20s are still talking to me about them not getting the corner office. They're talking about the book, and they're talking about how in the book things apply to them. And they're in their 20s. So glacial speed is what it is.
We're talking about women and niceness in the workplace with Lois Frankel, author of books including See Jane Lead and Nice Girls Still Don't Get the Corner Office. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a woman, have you felt niceness being a balancing act of sorts at work? Do you have your own personal strategy for striking that balance from people seeing you as too nice and a doormat, or too assertive and unlikable, I guess? Do you worry about being seen as too aggressive? If you're anyone in a workplace, what have you seen where you work? Are things getting better from your perspective? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Lois Frankel, author and expert in leadership development for women. Her many books include Nice Girls Still Don't Get the Corner Office. We're talking about a balancing act women can face over how nice to be at work versus how assertive. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a woman, have you felt a push and pull in your job over being either too nice or too assertive, or maybe both at the same time somehow? Do you opt for one or the other? Have you found a balance? What communication strategies do you use in your work that you think men might not have to consider using themselves? Do you have questions for our guest, too, about maybe a situation you've faced in the workplace? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lois, I want to lay out another scenario that you hear about from time to time. A woman offers idea, maybe in a meeting. Nobody really hears it or pays attention to it. Somebody else, maybe a guy, gives the same idea. Then there's a response and a conversation. The woman in that situation, how can she deal with that?
Yeah, we call that bropriating. When a man appropriates, it's usually a man, appropriates an idea as his own. And there's one thing you can do before, and there's one thing that you can do after it happens. The before is something that's called amplification, that you need to get the rest of the women in your office to amplify each other's ideas in meetings. So that if we're sitting around and I put an idea out, another woman might say, hey, Lois, I think that that's a great idea. I think we should, you know, do it because whatever. Now it's almost impossible for someone to appropriate that idea from me. So that's what women should be doing for each other. Now, let's say you're not doing that and it happens in a meeting. A woman has to practice doing this and she needs to be able to do it right off the cuff and with a smile on her face. So let's just say, Rob, you took one of my ideas at a meeting. What I might say when you're finished talking is, oh, Rob, thank you so much for coming back to my idea. In fact, it made me think I'd like to add a little bit to it. Now, again, that's kind of tongue-in-cheek, and it's very nice, but I've made it clear that it was my idea.
So, Lois, I had this idea where a woman could speak up after the man steals the... Oh, no, wait, I'm doing it now. I'm sorry.
So, yeah, oh, thanks so much for coming back to my idea, Rob.
Exactly. Okay, we demonstrated there. Now, is there something... Now this is, you're focusing on the women here because they're dealing with these realities. Are there structural things you think we could be doing at workplaces so that women don't have to do this balancing act?
Yeah, you know, I think leaders, both female and male leaders, both need to make sure that the playing field is even. And they need to look at their own biases. And I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, bias training, because I don't really think that helps in the long run. But rather, really just each of us taking a look at our own behaviors towards women and how we treat them. So, for example, in a meeting, if I was a leader and I noticed that the women were speaking up less than the men, which is almost always the case, I'd say, let's hold on a minute. We haven't heard from everybody. I want to make sure we get all the ideas on the table. Or if, as a leader, I see somebody steal someone else's idea, being able to say, you know, Rob, I'm really glad that you followed up on Lois's idea because I thought it was a good one too. So we really need leaders who are going to start doing some of that for the women in their workplace.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Brenda is with us in Grafton. Brenda, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Brenda?
I wanted to say that it can be very difficult to be a woman in the workplace, and especially as an executive. And it depends on where you are in the United States, because women do, I believe, have to adjust their personality depending on if they're in New York, San Francisco, or even, say, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And anytime a woman speaks up, sadly, they're immediately characterized as aggressive, perhaps bullying, and many other words are used. And that really hurts us. And it hurts us from being able to grow. And I've been fortunate enough to make it in the top 1%. and have been the only female sitting at the table in board meetings. And it's amazing if you speak up, how you're referred to differently than if a man speaks up.
Brenda, thanks a lot for the call. Lois, what do we lose if we're keeping people from Brenda from getting that seat at the table and speaking up in the first place?
Yeah, Brenda brings up a couple of good points, and let me speak to something she said, and then I'll answer your question. She talked about regional differences, and that's absolutely true. There's not only regional differences, but I think women need to understand that the workplace is a playing field. There's rules, boundaries, and strategies, and those rules, boundaries, and strategies are different for men and women, as she's already found, and she's already actually played well because she became an executive. But those rules, boundaries, and strategies, as she said, change regionally, and they change from company to company. So what might work for Brenda in Wisconsin, at a company in Wisconsin, let's just say she works for Oshkosh, what may work there, if she came to Los Angeles and worked at Warner Brothers Films, the exact same behavior that was successful might not work. And so it's important to get the lay of the land and understand the rules of your playing field. That's critical. Going back to your question about what do we lose when women's voices aren't at the table, we lose a whole lot because what we know is that in diversity, and whether that's diversity in gender, whether it's diversity in race, experience, whatever it is, in diversity, there is much more of an abundance of good ideas than when we're only hearing it from one type of person. If we hear it from all white males, for example, the idea might be great, but if you add in people who see the world differently, who have a different lens on the world, you're going to get exponentially better results. And that is shown, it has been shown in studies, that the most diverse workplaces often have the most, the greatest return on investment.
Brenda, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Lois Frankel. Her books include Nice Girls Still Don't Get the Corner Office, talking about challenges for women over being nice and being assertive in the workplace. Back to your calls now. Andrew is with us in Port Washington. Andrew, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Andrew?
So I think My interpretation on this is that the onus for change should not be put on the marginalized population. I think it's important for men to make the space for women so they don't have to walk this balancing beam between being nice and being assertive. I think that men have the privilege to do that, and it's our job to make that space so that women can be themselves and provide that women's perspective that we need in our workplace.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Lois, what do you think?
Yeah, Andrew, thank you. I'm giving you a mental high five. I hope you see it. because, you know, although it's interesting what you're saying, I'm not suggesting that the onus is on men at all. Because I really believe there, and that's the whole purpose of Nice Girls Still Don't Get the Corner Office. The subtitle is Unconscious Mistakes Women Make That Sabotage Their Careers. So my message to women is, before you point a finger at men, make sure you are doing what you need to do to be taken seriously. So there are, and that's why it's called Nice Girls, because you can't act like the nice little girl you were taught to be in childhood and expect to achieve your adult goals. Certainly Brenda wasn't able to do that. She became an adult woman. So then, yes, once you make sure you're doing that, then I also like to bring men to the table and say, yes, if you have privilege, then with that privilege comes responsibility. And the responsibility that comes with that is to be inclusive in all ways. And it's about women, it's people of color, it's LGBT, the LGBTQ community, whatever it is, that with that inclusivity, we see exponentially better results.
Thanks for the call, Andrew. Rena joins us now in Franklin. Rena, hi.
Hi. I haven't heard anything about the Ginger Rogers principle. You know, she did everything that Fred Astaire did, except backwards and in high heels.
Yeah, that's true. I can't say any more than that, and you're absolutely right. What do you think of that, though?
Well, I am in my mid-60s. I'm about to retire. And, oh, boy, even when you do everything and They respect you for your abilities and your intelligence, and yet they resent you for your abilities and your intelligence. And, you know, it has changed since the 70s, but there's a lot of resentful guys out there.
Rena, thanks for the call. So even if you do things right, Rena says people might resent you, Lois.
Yeah, that's true. And that's why it's so important to have those relationships in place. If you notice, that's what I started with, because it's a lot harder to resent you when people like you. And likability is an important ingredient for success for both men and women. Right, we have a very, very scientific test in our office, and it's called the beer test. And when I meet you, would I like to go out and have a beer, a cup of coffee, or a glass of wine with you? And if the answer is no, you fail the likability test, because likability is so incredibly important to your success. And that's true for both men and for women. Also, Rena brought up something important, which is it's not the people who accomplish the most or are the smartest or are the best educated, they're not always the ones who get the furthest. They're not always the ones who are getting promoted. It's the ones who have relationships in place, who add value by giving their opinion. You know, I can't tell you how many people that I've coached, and they were sent to me for coaching because people said, I know they're really bright, but they're not adding any value because they won't disagree with me. They won't argue. You know, they'll never bring up a diverse opinion, even though they have them. And that's often because they're afraid of people in authority. But you need to make sure that it's like a 360-degree process being successful in the workplace.
Rena, thanks for that call. And Lois, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Rob, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Lois Frankel, author, consultant, and expert on leadership development for women. Her books include See Jane Lead and Nice Girls Still Don't Get the Corner Office. She talked with us about pressures women can face over being nice in the workplace. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a Native American Wisconsinite about what he hopes people take away from the state's first Indigenous Peoples Day. And by the way, the candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination face each other for their next debate Tuesday night, tomorrow night at 7. Join us for live coverage and analysis from NPR. That's tomorrow night at 7. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll check in on a leadership program for African-American women here in Wisconsin. Now, for the first time, the state of Wisconsin is recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day. Governor Evers signed an executive order last week honoring the state's Native Americans on the second Monday in October. The move does not replace state and federal observances of Columbus Day. Vermont, Maine, and New Mexico are also marking their first Indigenous Peoples Days this year. Madison and Milwaukee have commemorated the event in recent years. Evers' proclamation came after students at Indian Community School in Franklin, just south of Milwaukee, advocated for the holiday. WISN-TV says the students had been calling for Indigenous Peoples Day for 3 years. Aaron Bird Bear is the Assistant Dean for Student Diversity Programs in the UW-Madison School of Education. Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, I'm happy to be here.
Well, what was your reaction to the state declaring today as Indigenous Peoples Day?
I think it's a wonderful acknowledgement of the 12,000 years of human life here in the Western Great Lakes. It actually goes back to 13,000 years if we look at the southern shore of Lake Michigan, kind of near Racine, is kind of the oldest known human life kicking it here in the Western Great Lakes. And so acknowledging that full history instead of just the colonial history, or I call the colonial veneer, which is when these new residents from other continents and the other hemisphere join us here in Turtle Island. And so I think Indigenous Peoples Day is just a wonderful acknowledgement of the full humanity of this place.
At Turtle Island, can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, Turtle Island is just a way that some of the First Nations of the kind of Northeast in their creation stories of this kind of the world and the universe around us describe where we're at. So Turtle Island is just a name for what we now call North America. The people there knew that they were surrounded by water in many ways and ascribed the name Turtle Island, which also references a little about how this place came to be.
We've got this declaration now in Wisconsin. Other communities and states are doing this as well. How are you hoping that from year to year, Indigenous Peoples Day is marked and celebrated?
Yeah, I really understand the reason why kind of this time had Columbus Day as a holiday enacted as an official kind of U.S. holiday in 1934. 1972 became the official date, the second holiday Monday of the year under President Nixon. And at the time, you know, Italians and Italian Americans were facing a tremendous amount of discrimination and oppression in various ways as the immigrant of the population of the day. And Columbus Day was a way to think about how we could celebrate this diverse group of people who've joined our society. But now when we look back and we see the history of Columbus being a little more challenging in his murder, slavery, sex trafficking, the fact that he never set foot on North America or even saw North America, and then we ascribe this day of kind of a day of discovery in some ways a little problematic. And so having Indigenous Peoples Day recognized today as just shows us the full humanity of the space in ways that I think is wonderful.
What kind of lessons do you, apart from what you were just talking about with Columbus and his legacy, what kind of things do you want to celebrate on a holiday like this?
I think it's just understanding the conscious cultural connection to place that Indigenous people have. Our cultures, our languages were formed over thousands of years of intimately knowing this place, this environment, the animal species, the plant species around us. And so I'm hopeful that people are interested in learning a deeper perspective of the space instead of just the colonial veneer that really thin the last 1.5% of our story, which is the 1848 forward, or even the 1600s still present is only the last 4% of the human story. That through this time, we would kind of understand the perspective of Indigenous peoples and their cultures and ways of being that have been shaped by intimately being connected to this land and place for so long.
Talking to Aaron Bird Bear, Assistant Dean for Student Diversity Programs in the UW-Madison School of Education, looking at today being declared Indigenous Peoples Day here in Wisconsin and in other communities around the country. There has been an argument, Aaron, from some people saying, yes, absolutely, let's have an Indigenous Peoples Day, but let's not have it on the same day as Columbus Day, including Milwaukee Alderman Bob Donovan, who told WISN-TV that it shouldn't be on the same day. He calls it political correctness run amok. There's a quote there. What do you think of that idea? Let's do it, but on a different day.
I think Columbus Day as a holiday just needs a reexamination. I think we kind of discussed today what it represents in the terms of the beginning of settler colonialism. And settler colonialism has a goal of kind of erasing and obscuring the full humanity of the space in some way. And so if we even think about the name Wisconsin, if we ask people, well, what does that name mean culturally? Like, define the word Wisconsin for us. I think this kind of really thin veneer, this colonial veneer, this understanding of this space is very limited. And that Columbus Day in some ways obscures the kind of full humanity of the space in some way. And once again, I mentioned earlier, if we look into the history of Columbus as a person, and that he enslaved 550 Native Americans and returned to them on his second voyage back to Europe, and then the kind of sex trafficking and violence and mass murder that happened in the Caribbean under his leadership, that is this really a person that we want to teach as a celebrated person for the youth of the United States today? And I think the youth are very woke today, and they recognize that, you know, glorifying leaders who engaged in sex trafficking, enslavement, and murder is maybe not the best leaders for us to objectify today.
Now, this is just one day. What kind of things would you like to see, say, in school settings, not just today, but maybe throughout the history curriculum and the geography curriculum and others for that matter? What would you like to see change to talk about some of these issues more?
Yeah, I think we've had federal declarations that November is National Native American Heritage Month. We have this movement where numerous states now have declared Indigenous Peoples Day and I think it's like 129 cities or something have declared Indigenous Peoples Day in some way. But I hope that we would begin to, instead of just kind of looking at one place in time, that integrating in our, particularly our public education curriculum, throughout the entire year, awareness of how humans have engaged this place for so long. And so it would be wonderful to have like a 13 moons curriculum where we would kind of see the cultural activity and ways of being of humans as they've engaged wherever place you're in over the calendar. And I think here in southern Wisconsin, the Ho-Chunk Nation, whose ancestral land, the University of Wisconsin, is located where I work, they were incredibly industrious and productive corn farmers, and we kind of understand their way of being if we look at how they named the seasons, the 13 moons. Like, one of them is like corn popping moon, and the times to plant the corn. And I think we would get a sense of our connection to the space if we thought about a 13 moons, a year-round integration of how humans have made such high quality of life on Turtle Island in the United States for such a long period of time.
Now, looking back, to the extent that I learned about Native American heritage in the United States, it was kind of a generic one-size-fits-all approach. And the more I learn and read about it, there's an incredible diversity in the history and present day among Native Americans. Can we start to tackle that more, do you think?
Yeah, I always just say all continents are diverse. You know, it's like we don't expect people from Northern Europe to be like people from Southern Europe, either culturally or linguistically. I think the people of Finland are very different than the people of Greece. And the same can be ascribed to our continent, to Turtle Island. Today, there are 573 American Indian and Alaska Native nations who are federally recognized by the U.S. government, meaning they have a treaty-based relationship with the United States government. And within that 573 First Nations, we still have 169 different Native American languages spoken today. So I think continents are extraordinarily diverse, and I think although the colonial veneer has kind of obscured the incredible diversity of this continent, we need to think about the diversity in the same ways we ascribe to Europe or other continents. I know Africa suffers the same kind of fate in some ways, that we don't really understand the full diversity of that incredible continent where humans have been living for such a long period of time. And I hope that people dig in a little deeper to this continent to understand the great cultural and linguistic diversity represented by Native Americans who've called this place home for thousands of years.
As we wrap up, what kind of conversations do you hope people start having after today's Indigenous Peoples Day?
Well, I hope we just want to know who our contemporary Native American First Nations neighbors and community members are today. It's wonderful to understand who we are as a people. We're grounded in the traditions of our ancestors. We have our ancestors standing behind us. And we hopefully understand that all the tribal sovereignty in these wonderful ways of being have sustained us, that extraordinary, resilient, and resourceful people who've endured and engaged a lot of change, but also have created a lot of change for the United States as well. And I hope we just want to celebrate our contemporary First Nations neighbors and get to know the Native American nations around us today.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay. Well, Che Miigwech, Pinigigi, thank you so much, and have a wonderful Indigenous Peoples Day.
Aaron Bird Bear is the Assistant Dean for Student Diversity Programs in the UW-Madison School of Education. We talked with him about Governor Evers' executive order declaring today Indigenous Peoples Day in Wisconsin, the first time the state has recognized the Columbus Day alternative. Coming up, we'll talk with the founder of Wisconsin's Progress Center for Black Women nearly a year after opening a physical location in Fitchburg. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, House Democrats heard testimony behind closed doors today as they continue an impeachment inquiry into President Trump over his dealings with Ukraine. We'll talk about what we learned today and after the testimony of three other current or former administration officials. First, about a year ago, Sabrina Madison opened a location in Fitchburg for the organization she founded called the Progress Center for Black Women. She describes the mission of the Progress Center as creating more Black women who are leaders, doers, and owners. Sabrina has also organized several Black women leadership conferences. Sabrina Madison joins us now in our studio. Sabrina, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me here today.
Well, congratulations on the almost anniversary.
Yes.
What are you, as I mentioned, you're trying to create leaders, doers, and owners among mm-hmm. African-American women. Can you talk about what you're doing and how you're doing it?
Yeah, back in 2016, I decided to quit my job and literally just go to work for Black women. I had already been taking speaking engagements across the country, but what was happening here at my home in Madison, I wasn't seeing us in leadership spaces, and it was just bothering me, like really agitating me. So I said, I'm going to give up my full-time job and work literally full-time for Black women.
What are some of the obstacles facing black women in a community like, say, the Madison area?
Pay is a really, really huge one. Once I started doing the numbers and really researching what we're earning, I learned that we were only earning about 57 cents on a dollar in Dane County. So pay disparities is a big one. And then we're not in leadership spaces where we're making the decisions. We're in charge of the hiring and the firing and the, you know, looking out for our fellow women in the workplace.
So when you're working with women, African-American women in, say, Dane County, what kind of advice do you give them as individuals to help overcome some of those hurdles?
To be honest, the biggest one that I always give is not to give up, to not allow the burden of what can be a black woman living in Madison to sort of like hold, sort of like break you down. Because it can be heavy. It can be heavy being the only black woman in a workspace, the only black woman in a workspace making not a great pay. So the first and foremost is always to not allow what the hardness of living here to be such a burden that it breaks you down and you give up and not continue to go on.
We've been hearing a lot, I think, especially in recent years, kind of in Madison, this idea, okay, you've got this history of Madison as a liberal community that people at least think of themselves as being an inclusive place. And then hearing from African-Americans and saying, well, hold on, that's not really how we're experiencing it. Can you talk about that? That difference of understandings of where Madison is.
So I moved here with my son, who's now about to be 25. He was in his second half of sixth grade, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. And I moved here with rose-colored glasses. We moved from the Milwaukee area. I had come on a vacation here. I was like, oh, my God, it's beautiful. The lakes are beautiful. It's clean. I didn't really hear gunshots. There's no shooting. I just felt, hey, it's a pretty safe place. Within a month here, I lost count of how many times I was asked, did I move from Chicago? We were from Milwaukee. I remember getting told to go back to Chicago in a shared ride cab by two like overly drunk white guys. Like that's my 1 month here. Like, welcome to Madison. Go back to Chicago.
Do you see similar things in workplaces?
Yes. Where I worked for about 13 or so years, I dealt with that regularly. At one point, I was the only black woman who was an employer, staff employee in the entire building, where the only other black folks I would see would be students or janitorial staff. You deal with instances where you're not taken to be smart enough or having the intelligence to lead something in the workplace, too. So,
seems like a challenge is to get to a critical mass where there's enough African-American people, black women in particular, in a workplace, but nobody wants to be the only black woman in the workplace and the hurdles that that entails. How do you get from that place to that place?
It's about to be honest, I think it's networking. It's teaching, at least from my experience, it's been about connecting with other black women leaders, even if they weren't in a shared space with me, and helping them get the skills that they need to sort of like advocate for themselves, but also to teach black women, especially how to have advocates for them in the workplace. There are women who come and meet with me one-on-one and they don't even necessarily understand how to grow within their workplace. They may have met with HR and they really didn't explain with them how this growth chart works. So it's giving women the power by just educating them on how to sort of navigate and strategically navigate leadership at the workplace.
Talking to Sabrina Madison, founder of the Progress Center for Black Women, based now in Fitchburg. Now, you've been doing this without an HQ, I guess, a physical space. Now you have this. What has that changed for you?
Oh, my God. It's beautiful. I see women sort of their physical selves transform when they enter into the space. So part of the reason why I wanted the physical space is that I'm moving around Dane County and the rest of the state quite often, and I wasn't seeing a space where I can walk into and feel as if the space reflected me, like the art on the walls reflected me, the furniture descriptions or options reflected me. And so I wanted to create a space where black women walked into and they just feel good. So you'll see black women walk into the space. They may see Michelle Obama's book on one end, a piece of art to the right that literally can sort of look like them or their daughter. And there is an emotional reaction to that. You have women who get to the back of our space and by the time they're back there, they're in tears because they've never experienced that. And some of these women have lived in Madison all their lives and not experienced that.
You've also organized conferences. And I saw in reporting, and I'm sorry, I don't remember which outlet reported it, but talking, some of the people attending saying they felt like they had a space to breathe.
Yes. So the very first one I put on in spring 2016, and the reason I kept going is because of this woman. She stood up. She said, I've lived in Madison for 14 years and I've never experienced this. This was simply a space where they were all mostly predominantly Black women. Black women were delivering the content. They were empowering each other. There was no sort of like bad energy, but just all this healthy, good vibes. And so to be in a space where you don't have to worry if someone's going to ask you, are you using this desk, or making some sort of reference to your hair, where you're just comfortable, you know.
What would you say to people, say white people, maybe well-meaning, who are managing a workplace, or that HR person to who are thinking, okay, I want to make a better workplace, but maybe I just don't have the cultural literacy?
I always say if you have folks of color already employed in your workspace, they're your answer. I often see folks will come to me and say, Sabrina, I don't know how to create more equity in my workplace. I'm like, are you asking people of color to the table, or are you trying to create and lead it all on your own? I think one of the very first, to me, obvious steps is to sit down genuinely with women of color or folks of color to build, you know, a more equitable workplace.
Is there a way to set up the space to do that, though? Because if I'll try to put myself in the shoes of the only African-American woman in a workplace.
Yep.
Even if I'm asked, do I feel safe, like, saying, well, here's what I see is wrong here?
What I'm saying is that for white folks listening, we need white folks to be real, genuine allies. Me, Black woman, if I'm the only one in a workspace, it's going to be very difficult for me to take the lead and create that on my own without the support of my colleagues. So we really need white folks at the table to say, I am interested in creating with you a more equitable workplace. I'm going to partner with you in a genuine way. And then be willing to sort of like fall back. You don't have to lead everything, but, you know, fall back and allow us to lead but partner with us in a genuine way.
Do you feel like there's some success stories already that you can start pointing to?
We have tons of success stories. Probably the most recent is a woman. She had shied away from coming to the conference. I think the first 2 years, she didn't know if it was quite for her. But she finally came in year three, and she got everything she needed. She was in a job where she had been considering applying for a supervisory role. She finally came to meet with me, got some advice on how to approach the conversation with her HR person, came to the conference year four, which was this past May. She is now not only supervisor, she is sort of like a entry-level manager at that position. So
in my reading up, you have a reputation of somebody, a lot of people talk about things, you have a reputation of talking about things and then taking action. What is it that allows you to try to do that, to just hear this and say, okay, how do we work our way around this?
Because I not that I condone everyone going out being team parents, but I think it was because I had a kid 2 weeks of my 16th birthday. And so I've literally had to solve problems since I was 15 quickly and without a lot of resources. And I've always been someone who was very frustrated by people who complain and don't act. And what I saw was happening in Madison was almost like this attraction to failure, money being dumped into programs or initiatives or studies. And I'm like, this has already been done. It's just a new name, new label, and I'm sick of it. So I've always been an action-oriented sort of person.
Now, we're hearing all over the state and outside of the state, too. Mm-hmm. If there's another Sabrina Madison to be out there thinking, wait a minute, maybe I could do that, what would you say to her?
Girl. I would start with girl. Find the other Black women in your network or in your city within, I don't know, 20 blocks of where you're sort of like centered at, and invite those women out for coffee or tea or whatever, and just sit down with them, because we are so isolated. I am still sometimes isolated here, and I have a pretty expansive network. But what we have to realize is that we're all dealing with similar things, but we need each other in order to survive it all. So,
and then talk to the African-American woman who's running into some of the obstacles we talked about at the beginning. What would you tell her?
Find me at the Progress Center for Black Women. I always say, find me no matter where you're at. I just had a phone call with a woman from Jacksonville this morning who's wanting to do similar things. But again, it's going to be figure out the best path to identify Black women leaders, whether they're in politics, whether in education, no matter what lane, because we all have some similarities no matter where we're leading. And don't try to lead in isolation.
Okay, you've got a lot on the table, clearly. What's next? What's the next project on your mind?
Yeah, so I've been doing the Black Women's Leadership Conference for the last 4 years, and I remember I said I don't like stale things. I want things to be fresh, and I want things to be changing. And so the conference will become the Wisconsin Black Women's Leadership Week, because I'm very concerned how we're not necessarily coordinating and collaborating collaborating across the state. And I want us to be a bit more effective and tight-knit. So the conference will identify leaders, Black women leaders from across the state, and we'll work together to put on events all across Wisconsin next year.
And when is that going to happen?
That happens the week of April 24th, and we cap it off May 3rd.
Sabrina, thanks so much for coming up to the studio and joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Sabrina Madison, founder of the Progress Center for Black Women. You can find more information about the Progress Center. Head over to our website. It's at WPR.org/Central Time. And if you have a story to share along the lines of what Sabrina has been talking about, we'd love to hear your story. You can email us ideas@WPR.org. Or you can reach us at Twitter. We are @CentralTimeWPR. Again, if you've got a story, if you're an African-American woman in the workplace, let us know how things are going for you. Tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Once again, Wisconsin may be on the verge of getting 16,000 square miles bigger. That's according to a Twitter account that claims to represent the entire Upper Peninsula of Michigan. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Twitter account called the Upper Peninsula of Michigan tweeted this weekend, "It's official, I belong to Wisconsin now." Why? That was a response to a tweet from Wisconsin Football with three football scores on it. Wisconsin 61, Central Michigan 0, Wisconsin 35, Michigan 14, Wisconsin 38, Michigan State 0, send us the deed, Upper Peninsula. Those were the scores in the three games the UW-Madison Badgers played against Michigan teams this season. The Upper Peninsula account went on in follow-up tweets. As of today, Northern Michigan University becomes Northern Wisconsin University, and Michigan Tech becomes Wisconsin Tech University. Also, weed is illegal again. Also, cheese pasties are now a thing. That all sounds pretty official to me, but I haven't reviewed the state constitutions of Michigan and Wisconsin to see if the social media account of a peninsula that's been personified has any real legal status. We'll have to go to the courts on that one. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.